I met him 15 years ago.
He's gone from here. The evil is gone.
I was told there was nothing left. No reason, no conscience, no understanding, and even the most rudimentary sense of life or death, of good or evil, right or wrong.
I wish I had you all along, just that.
You know, it's Halloween. I guess everyone's entitled to one good scare, huh?
I met this 6-year-old child with this blank, pale, emotionless face, and the blackest eyes, the devil's eyes. Death has come to your little town, Sheriff. You can either ignore it or you can help me to stop it.
Hey, jerk! Speed kills!
See anything you like?
Hey, Bonnie, get your ass away from there.
Seems to me you're just playing scared.
Killed him.
You can't kill the boogeyman.
I spent 8 years trying to reach him, and then another 7 trying to keep him locked up because I realized that what was living behind that boy's eyes was purely and simply evil.
I think there's really only one horror film that I can say registered with me at a young age and sort of set me on the path to loving horror. And it, of course, coincides with what's become my favorite time of the year. This stretch from, you know, late September all the way through the end of the year, to me, it's the best time of the year. And nothing really personifies that more than my favorite horror film, which I think sort of, in my opinion, started the slasher character as a convention and a trope. And the survivor girl, as I called it, or final girl, as Carol Clover called it. The idea of it being fall related, the leaves turning, all that stuff. There can be really only one film for me to discuss today.
Welcome back to Scream Addicts. I'm your host, Jason Jenkins. Call me Jenks. And that was David J. Stevie talking about John Carpenter's Halloween. Mr. Stevie is a writer and producer known for Behind the Mask, The Rise of Leslie Vernon, one of the best damned horror comedies ever made, which is now celebrating its, its 10th anniversary. Mr. Stevie, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thanks, James. Glad to be here, and always a pleasure to talk to fellow horror fans about the stuff we love, and thanks for having me on.
Certainly. So John Carpenter's Halloween, it's a complete classic. I mean, if you're a horror fan, that's pretty much horror movie number one. Can you tell me, why is it that you zeroed in on that one for discussion, and can you maybe tell us a bit about the first time you ever saw the film?
Oh, man. First time I ever saw the film, I in reverse order, I think, man, no one's ever asked me that before. I seem to have a memory of watching it with my older sister, Christine, and my cousins, Julie and Lori. I want to say we were at somebody's house being babysat or something like that, and I was the youngest of the bunch. So, I just remember not really understanding, I think, at that age what I was watching, but something resonated with me. Over the years, I think I've come to understand and appreciate that it's, you know, to me, Halloween it's the purest of them all. You know, it's certainly not scary by today's standards. It's certainly not gory by today's standards. So I think, you know, if there's somebody out there who has not seen it or going back to, you know, pick it up for the first time, you know, it's strange. People, if they don't know the history of it, it's kind of a boring movie to first time viewers in 2016. You know what I mean? So, but to me, it hit at the right time, at the right age. As I've grown older, I've really come to understand the symbolism of Michael Myers as, you know, the boogeyman. He's literally the boogeyman, the sort of faceless, driving sort of force that doesn't really need to be explained. Just is evil. And I think there's a purity in that. As a storyteller, I've always loved, and, you know, keep it simple, stupid, right? So it's just... It's everything I think that the slasher film should be. It's just, it's pared down. It's, you know, 1978. So it's just, it's sort of inception. It's sort of infant form. And I mean that in a good way.
Now, was Halloween the first film in the Halloween franchise that you managed to catch? Or are you like me in that you probably caught one of the sequels first?
No, I was watching Halloween first. I mean, it was, I was born in 71, so like I said, I'm sure I should not have been watching it, but I remember seeing it. It was on TV, of course, but so I don't know how long after that it would have been, but I definitely know that it was the first Halloween movie that I saw. The sequels, I don't have as sharp a memory of the sequels as I do of the original.
I envy you for that. My first Halloween movie was Halloween 5, watching it on television for the first time, and then I backtracked to Halloween 4, and eventually I made my way back to
So
going
what
back
you're
to the very
saying is,
beginning.
so you got better and better and better the more you discovered, is what you're saying.
Kind of, yeah, and I got to admit, having watched Halloween 5 for the first time, that being my first experience with the franchise, I still have kind of a soft spot for it, if I'm being honest. I can still recognize its flaws and the flaws in, many of those entries in the franchise, but I still I kind of love them all, except, Resurrection. But yeah, Halloween is definitely the best of the bunch. And it is funny you mentioned that it is, it isn't super scary and it isn't super gory the way a lot of those later movies, not only in the Halloween franchise, but in the sort of slasher cycle that Halloween inspired. It wasn't as gory as those later movies. And, it's more concerned with creating tension and, suspense and jolting the audience with, well-crafted scares. And
Yeah,
I have.
absolutely. I just got to interject there. I mean, if you when you watch it, it's Michael Myers is arguably the gentlest, kindest of the icons. This is he really doesn't do anything, terribly. He doesn't have Freddy Krueger's sort of sense of sadism. He's not quite as brutal as Jason is. There's no trickery. There's no devices. It's just him, and he's usually, it's a knife. It's strangling. It's not. There's really nothing. And especially in the first movie, I think there's only, four or five people that actually get killed, and there's very little blood. I don't think there's much blood at all. So it's, arguably he's the most humane. Is that a word you can say for a slasher killer?
Maybe. I don't think I've ever heard anyone refer to Michael Myers as humane, but I guess, relatively so.
Yeah, it's pretty. He gets you. It's pretty quick. It's pretty quick. There's not, it's pretty clean. There's not a lot of drawn out stuff. It's just sort of there he is, and it's over.
If you have to be killed by a slasher, might as well be him, right?
That's what I'm saying, yes.
Can I ask what, as a fan of the movie, what do you think drives Michael in that original film? If we can forget Halloween 2 and the revelation that Laurie is his sister, and if we forget Halloween 6 and the whole Thorn cult thing, what is Michael in this film? He kills his sister in the opening just because, and he sees a pretty young girl deliver a set of keys to his old house, and then he targets she and her friends. And there's this sort of, at times in the movie, there's kind of a playful malevolence to him. He stalks the girls. He pops out from behind corners. He dresses in sheets and sunglasses when he approaches Linda. He sets up bodies in a tombstone in bed like a house, like it's his own personal
Right.
haunted fun house. And in that sense, you get the feeling that, he really is the boogeyman or the shape. It's his intent to frighten, not merely kill. And I can't think of another slasher who's quite like him in that regard, even comparing him to the later versions of, the shape in that same franchise. And
Right.
it's interesting, I think.
I think, I mean, of that pantheon, I think, you can sort of put, Jason is in the same kind of a era in the history of the genre and that sort of thing. But Jason was driven, purely by rage and motivation. His motivation was clear. It was just revenge, and he was fixated with the place, and he was going to kill everybody that stumbled in there. That's sort of his drive. I think you're right. I think for me, at least, the appeal for Michael Myers is I like that it's not really explained. I mean, Donald Pleasance, has that, soliloquy in there where he says, he tried to get through to this kid and he realized that there just wasn't anything behind the eyes except evil. I like that. I like the idea that, as a storyteller, as a screenwriter, that mythic quality of Michael really resonates. It appeals to me. I think it appeals to most human beings. There's just something about a nameless, faceless killer. I am become death, right? There's nothing, there is no reasoning with him. There's nothing behind it. There is no cure. There isn't a moment you can sit down and say, "Hey, Michael, let's get to the bottom of why you're really acting like this." It's just, he's just a manifestation of death. And I think, since it was sort of early in the, I don't know if it was early in the genre and that's why it's been imitated so much, but I tend to subscribe to the theory that, you know, what appeals to us horror fans or people who like to be scared by that is exactly the fact that he is faceless, that, you know, he has a mask on, which, you know, he puts the mask on as a child. He's sort of learning this, this part of him is coming out, right? The first thing he does is, well, he grabs a knife, but the second thing he does is put on a mask because he realizes, in my brain, I think he needs to, that it's that part of him that's saying, I can't be identified with a specific human. I can't be identified with a specific face or a name, you know, or a representation. It has to be this nameless, faceless entity of evil that can appear anywhere out of any darkness, from the caves or anywhere, you know? So it's, there's something very mythic about Michael that I think doesn't need to be explained. And that's what appeals to me about him.
I agree. But, you know, it is curious to think. I think he was scariest when he was faceless, and he was scariest when he was simply the boogeyman in Carpenter's movies. But, you know, it's crazy to think then that of all of the Halloween movies and all of the sequels with Michael's, you know, more specific motivations for doing what he does, you know, going after his sister, going after family members, being part of a cult, you know, all of that, that it's in this original film that we actually see Michael's face at the end. And we never do in any of the other movies, which is kind of strange considering that of all the movies, this is one that keeps him the most pure in a way.
Yeah, I mean, I know what you mean. I thought, I just watched it again a couple days ago before this. And I think there's a moment there where, that, if anything, I think that moment where she, you know, she tears his mask off in the closet, that's to me like that. I saw that again. I viewed that for the first time as like the last flash of his humanity. Like that's almost like that, that echo, that ghost, that, you know, it's right before he gets shot and falls off. And you know, there's a threshold he crosses, obviously, when, you know, he's hurt by Laurie, then he gets shot by Loomis. Sorry, spoiler alert, by the way. But when he falls off, you know, literally he sort of transcends, he falls off the balcony, right? And there's that threshold that he crosses from, for me, to being that sort of, you know, he's just a really driven human, where he finally crosses over that into what he's going to become for the rest of the franchise. But I don't know, I think that that moment where we see his face, I didn't freeze frame it or anything, but it does seem like he has sort of a pained look on his face. And I think that's the last of his humanity dying.
Yeah, absolutely. And, it, you know, how crazy is it to think that the first time you see the movie and you see him wearing that grotesque mask, and for all the talk of him being the boogeyman throughout and all of the terrible things that he does, you can only imagine what's hiding behind that big white mask that he wears. And then when it's finally torn away with, you know, looking past the fact that he's just had one of his eyes stabbed out, he's a normal looking guy. He's relatively right. Handsome. He's not a monster. And I think that makes him even scarier as a result. This notion that anybody could be that in a way.
Yeah, and I think that's, again, to me, it's, you know, it's his transcendence there where, you know, he does have to become sort of this not faceless, you know, he clearly has a very defined look, but the idea that, you know, his features are masked, his humanity is masked, excuse me, from that point forward, I think really lends to the creation of him. You know, to me, again, it's mythic. So to me, he's the boogeyman, and that's a mythic creature that can be, you know, manifest in any shape or form or any culture. So I think it just, I don't know. There, like I said at the beginning, the simplicity of the film, the simplicity of what it sets up at its core, that's what still appeals to me, and I think still holds up.
Yeah, and, you know, you mentioned boogeyman. For all of the talk of the boogeyman in the film, there isn't really anything supernatural that happens throughout the bulk of the film. You know, Michael is a psychopath with a knife that stalks and kills people. You know, that's relatively simple. And yet, when the film comes to a close, Loomis has just emptied a gun into him, you know, and he simply gets up and walks away after falling off that balcony. And, you know, we close the film with Laurie saying it was the boogeyman, as though the movie is telling us that we've been witnessing up until that point a very supernatural tale. We just didn't necessarily know it at the time. And yeah, that's certainly the case with the later films, I think, which is, you know, kind of surprising, I think. I can't think of many slasher movies or many horror movies that sort of holds that, you know, so close to the vest throughout the entire runtime of the film, you know, until the very end, as it were.
And you know, another thing you maybe reminded me of is another thing I love about this movie is that it's one of the few that I can think of. Maybe you can think of a couple other ones, but even throughout the entire setup of the film, Loomis is pretty adamant about what Michael is. You know, there's no question coming from him. He's like, no, this guy is evil. It's a thing. It's an it. You know, we need to stop it. And he doesn't really get any pushback. Like, even the cop in Haddonfield, pretty much, again, watching this again, refresh this, but I love it that the cop is like, okay, I hope you're wrong, but I'm going to stick with you, and, you know, I'll go check out this side of the house. And, you know, it's, there's none of that trope we get in most slasher films, which is like, oh, you're being silly, or oh, you're overreacting, or oh, it's just the wind. You know, it's, yeah, I like that even in the very small, it's a very small cast, obviously, but even in that community, that world they've created in Haddonfield, it's, you know, Loomis is onto him and turns out to be right. You know, Laurie comes around. The cop never really pushes back and says, you're crazy, blah, 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 blah. And then you're right. At the end, they're sort of all proven right. No one's an idiot in this movie. And, you know, that says a lot about horror, a slasher genre, especially, you know, through the 80s and 90s. You know, everybody is pretty much realizing they're dealing with something unpleasant here. They don't know what it is, but they're keeping an open mind about it. And I don't know there are a lot of other horror movies out there like that where somebody doesn't say, oh, you're being silly.
Yeah, and that's crazy to think, too, that wasn't even always the case with Loomis in the later entries in the franchise. Like Halloween 4, he's treated like being this crazy old man, and it's like, does no one remember the events of Halloween 1 and 2? Does no one remember that this son of a bitch was completely right step for step throughout this franchise?
Right.
And yet... Yeah, it does seem to be a weird sort of trope that happens where, you know, the smartest, most driven people in these movies who are completely right are treated like, you know, insane people.
And I think that's an unfortunate side effect of, you know, where we are sort of, I don't want to throw my kind under the bus, but, you know, there's a certain expectation of screenwriters and then, you know, production executives and or development executives and people that, you know, you have to generate conflict. You have to generate conflict. If you're not without conflict, you're lost. And so, of course, no one believes them and no one believes the person who really has the truth and no one else sees the killer but the victim. And it's, I think we've sort of painted ourselves into a corner. You know, as viewers and storytellers and screenwriters and development people, as I said, we're sort of slaves to this conflict thing. And I think that's where a lot of this comes, because what's better conflict than having somebody pounding their fists on the window saying, no, turn around, you know, and nobody believes them. So, you know, it's unfortunate, but I get that, again, in Halloween, the original isn't really very suspenseful. It's really not. There's only a handful of moments where there's any shocks or, you know, you kind of see what's coming. You kind of see Michael coming the whole time. And he's seen a lot during the daytime. He's seen a lot during the daylight hours, which is also unique.
Driving around in a Smith's Grove sanitarium car, no less. I mean, he's in plain sight in the entire film until it turns night, at which point he sort of recedes into the shadows. But
standing on the sidewalk, you know, he's standing in the between the sheets of the clothesline. He's out there. He confronts Bobby or whatever, the little kid. You know, this is not a guy who's waiting till midnight, you know?
We're talking about Sam Loomis here. I mean, he's got to be one of the greatest heroes, I think, in all of horror films. Like, and he's what you referred to as an Ahab in Behind the Mask with your Doc Halloran character played by Robert Englund. And, you know, rather than being like a fanatic driven by hate, as with Melville's Captain Ahab, both Loomis and Halloran seem to be driven by this sort of need to do good and protect others. And I was wondering if Loomis was, would you say he was your sole inspiration for Doc Halloran, or just one of many, would you say?
It's overwhelmingly Loomis. I mean, he's the king, you know, but I think I keep reverting back to this sort of mythic storytelling. That's what drives a lot of my writing, is that you know, Loomis himself is an archetype. There is always the Obi-Wan character. There is always the wise old sage in the woods who has the answer. You know, it's oh my God, what's from the Jaws, Shaw's character in Jaws.
Oh, Quint.
Yeah, Quint. I mean, Quint was another, you know, sort of inspiration there, where there, you have somebody who knows what's up. There's always that. But, I mean, the archetype was there, is what I'm saying. And Loomis was just sort of the clearest example of that archetype. And to me, you know, once I started thinking about, you know, Behind the Mask and what went into that character construction and, you know, what and who Leslie Vernon was, and I started to sort of deconstruct that genre lovingly, it was, you know, pretty clear that we needed a Donald Pleasance type character. Overwhelmingly Loomis, but Loomis himself was, you know, already sort of ingrained in my memory, sort of in more of a mythic sense.
Yeah, and how great is Donald Pleasence in that role? You know, I'm a huge Christopher Lee fan, and as much as I love him, and I do, I can't really imagine anybody else playing, you know, Loomis but Donald Pleasence. And, you know, apparently Christopher Lee was up for the role and turned it down. But, you know, Pleasence is incredible playing this guy who is, you know, he's a good man, sure, and he's driven. But, you know, you can tell even in that first movie, he's more than a little unhinged at times.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's whether it was an acting choice or whether it was just a directing choice, or I don't know what it was, but I love that he just barely starts to chew the scenery a little bit when he's talking about him. But he, even, you know, it's not even Donald Pleasence, just sort of reined it in just on the edge of it almost becoming comic, you know, well, like when he's talking about him, like to pull off a conversation about a 6-year-old being evil could have been handled pretty poorly. It could have been pretty campy. And, you know, but he towed that line the whole time where it was just far enough that he didn't go into parody. You know, and I love that about the performance.
But it only built and built and built, I think, with the franchise. You know, he's a little crazier in 2. He's even, you know, more unhinged in part 4. And then in part 5, you have him dangling poor Jamie Lloyd in front of Michael and, you know, screaming Michael's name while beating him with a wooden plank. It just goes into, you know, really crazy territory. And yet, you know, to be fair to Pleasence, he always sells those moments. But, you know, but looking back at that original movie, Loomis has sort of his own journey in the film, which is completely separate from Laurie Strode in the film. And that's pretty much true of Loomis throughout the entire franchise. I mean, in Halloween 2, he's paired up with Sheriff Brackett and Deputy Hunt. And then, you know, jumping ahead to Halloween 4, he spends most of the movie traveling to Haddonfield and then partnering with the new sheriff there, Sheriff Meeker. And, you know, I'm just wondering, as a writer, do you think that, well, an Ahab is at his most effective when he's separated from the hero of the movie, or the heroine in this case? And if so, why is that, do you think?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, I think just by definition, the, you know, part of the Ahab is, you know, that Ahab monster relationship is, you know, it is sort of tormented. It is sort of, it's tragic in a way. It's almost, you know, it's like a dark sort of twisted love story in a way. They're sort of better apart. But they both desperately need each other. And, you know, I think it's weird. The Ahab character needs his monster much more than vice versa. But, you know, sort of the joke that we explore in Behind the Mask is that, you know, almost part of an Ahab's job, whether they like it or not, is marketing, is promotion. You know, the Ahab's presence, they're the ones out there touting, you know, the existence of the whale or the monster. They're the ones trying to tell everybody, no, you need to be aware of this. So it's sort of this reverse weird promotional thing that Ahabs do for their monster. But when they come together, obviously it's tough. It's got to resolve itself one way or another. So, I mean, the relationship, obviously they can't exist together for long, because they'll either destroy each other or one of them will win or some, you know what I mean? They can't carry on to perpetuity unless they're separated. So I don't know, I guess it's sort of, maybe, a sun and planet type of relationship where, you know, they sort of revolve around one another and they do have an effect on each other. But, you know, if they're not locked in motion, it, you know, it's means sort of the end for one or both of them.
Very true. And, you know, I, so far as the flip side to, you know, to the Ahab coin, as it were, or maybe not the flip side necessarily, but we do have the other piece of the puzzle. You know, we have the boogeyman, we have the Ahab, and then we have the final girl or survivor girl, as in Behind the Mask. And here it's Laurie Strode. And, you know, I just spoke to Patrick Reynolds a couple of episodes ago, and he chose the Texas Chainsaw Massacre to talk about. And, you know, I mentioned to him that Sally Hardesty is pretty much, I think, my favorite final girl. But, you know, Laurie is amazing, too. And in many ways, Laurie is sort of much more of what we expect from final girls of that era. You know, she's very much the girl next door type, which, you know, Sally Hardesty wasn't necessarily. But how do you feel about Laurie Strode overall as a final girl, and, you know, in that sort of pantheon, as it were?
I can answer that by one of the sort of few times I get to name drop was I was at a premiere screening, or it was a horror movie festival screening or something like that, where I got to meet Jamie Lee Curtis, and That's one of the only times I felt, you know, like the palms sweating and felt the heart pounding a little bit. And, you know, it couldn't have been a less interesting interaction. And I was introduced to her and I said hello. And somebody, you know, I remember somebody mentioning that I'd written Behind the Mask. And, you know, again, she was absolutely wonderful and polite, but it was just sort of, you could tell that she's had that conversation 1,000 times and she hadn't seen the movie, unfortunately. But, you know, it was just in that 10-second interaction, I know that just how nervous I felt, it was entirely because I couldn't, that was one of the times in my life I couldn't really separate the actress from the character that I first saw her in. You know, to me, I was like, I was rational enough to know I'm meeting Jamie Lee Curtis, but I'm like, oh my God, this is Laurie Strode. This is crazy. And so, I mean, that's obviously, to me, she's, you know, the first. I mean, I agree. Texas Chainsaw Massacre, you know, being a close second, you know, Sydney Prescott, I guess, in a way, is another survivor girl or a final girl that influenced me while I was writing Behind the Mask, but it's not really even close. I mean, it's Jamie Lee is the queen. And I think, I don't know, it's interesting. I read recently that John Carpenter was saying that he'd never ever set out to create an expectation or sort of this genre staple that survivor or final girls were the pure chaste ones who didn't do drugs and didn't have sex. That was not his intention. In fact, he explained it as I read it that, you know, Laurie Strode sort of survives because she's paying attention, and all, you know, the other characters, you know, they're high or they're drunk or they're having sex. So they're sort of, their guard is down and they're just sort of not paying attention. And that's how the killers can kind of get the drop on them. And that, you know, Laurie was just, she was sober. She was taking care of some kids. She was, you know, she was used to being alone. So she was just sort of more hyper aware of her surroundings. It was never intended to be a moral, a commentary. And so that sort of evolved out of that. And it got latched onto by a lot of other, you know, subsequent films. But Laurie's definitely set, whether it was intentional or not, Laurie Strode set the bar, I think, in my opinion, for what it means to be a final girl. You know, she's sort of righteous. She's doing the right thing. She's putting the needs of other people first. She's not engaging in, you know, narcissistic stuff. And I think that, you know, to me, she's what started it all.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that. I mean, that, you know, there is that notion, you know, people talking about horror movies, especially the horror movies of the 80s, as having, you know, the final girls having to be sort of virginal good girls, you know, quote unquote, who don't do drugs or anything of that sort, you know, in order to be able to survive. And, you know, I think that is probably true of some of the movies of that era. It's not true of Halloween. You know, early on, you know, Laurie smokes a joint with Annie, you know, and, you know, she's pining over Ben Tramer. And there is that line that Annie has, you know, so you do think about things like that or whatever. I think it is strange that Halloween is lumped into that sort of group of movies that are meant to be, you know, sort of commentaries on morality in a way. And I'm glad you pointed out that that's not really true of that movie, even if it is one of the first of the slasher cycle.
It's, you know, it's, you're right. It's not, I mean, I think it gets lumped in retroactively from people who are, you know, they're just sort of looking to prove their argument, you know, or academically. I think it just sort of gets, you know, I mean, Carol Clover's work, right, is sort of the seminal work about the final girl. And I get it. But even if I'm not mistaken, even she sort of said, look, it's really not about, you know, being chaste and pure and virginal. It's sort of about, you know, feminist empowerment. And, you know, it's a woman that is able to sort of stand up to this, you know, those arguments go back and forth. But I don't know. I don't know where the idea of the virgin survives and the girl doesn't do drugs survives, but I don't know. I think it's a detriment to, I think it's a detriment to the genre moving forward. I think it's a detriment to, oh man, I don't know if I want to step on this, but it's, you know, it's silly from a woman's rights perspective. I mean, it's really a double standard to say, you know, only the purest survive. Well, pure by whose standards, you know? And it's not even, it doesn't really hold up. It doesn't hold up in Scream. It doesn't hold up some of the other horror. I don't know. I don't think it holds up in Texas Chainsaw Massacre. She's certainly not an innocent. So I don't know. You're right. I mean, the argument is always there, but the evidence doesn't seem to support it.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, when it comes to slasher movies, I mean, there's a sort of charge that a lot of horror movies of the 80s and 90s, arguably all the way up until today, but, you know, are that some are sort of inherently misogynistic in a way because the violence is always targeted on, you know, young women. And yet it is always women who are sort of the ones with the upper hand at the end of the film and who are ultimately the heroes of the movie. So how do you feel about the subgenre as a whole? Do you think there is a sort of misogyny there, or do you think that's sort of a misplaced notion?
I think there is. I mean, I think that, you know, it's the whole genre, subgenre, all of it, it's been so dissected. I mean, everybody's trying to deconstruct and reconstruct, and the meta, you know, awareness aspect and the, you know, films within films and the reflection of, you know, people citing movies in a movie. And, you know, it's, I don't know, it's been dissected and analyzed to death. But, I don't know. Isn't any time you put a female in jeopardy, it's sort of inherently misogynistic, I guess. But it's also a reflection of it's still a male dominated industry. Unfortunately, it's still, you know, it's still driven by, you know, I don't even know if I want to say that it's the film industry. I mean, we, as storytellers, again, it's always, you know, the damsel in distress. The hero is typically a male. I mean, it's so ingrained in our human, you know, that human gene for how we listen and understand stories that, you know, I don't know. I don't know how you disarm that or how you diffuse it. Certainly, I feel like stories are getting better and, you know, we're becoming more aware of that. And those sort of gender issues are obviously in the forefront. I think, you know, hopefully it's going to translate to our entertainment, but it takes a long time to turn a battleship. And this is thousands and thousands of years of storytelling.
Yeah, and, you know, we were talking about the final girl trope, as it were, and, you know, how silly it is, that notion, I think, that she has to be like the good girl type. And I think even, you know, so far as Jamie Lee Curtis is concerned, they were trying to turn that notion on its head with Halloween H2O, you know, the 20th anniversary movie, by having Laurie be, you know, an alcoholic and showing her in a relationship and just, you know, trying to run as far away from, you know, who that character was in the first film as they could. But, you know, she's so great in that franchise too. You know, she's a perfect choice for Laurie, not only because, you know, she's very good in the role, she's a very good actress, but it is kind of cool to be able to connect Halloween to its forebear Psycho by virtue of the fact that, you know, Jamie Lee Curtis was, Janet Leigh's daughter, you know, the star of Psycho. Yep. And, you know, it was so great, just as a fan, just as a horror nerd, to see Janet Leigh pop up in Halloween H2O, albeit briefly, you know, driving even the very same car from Psycho.
Right. I just realized I'm completely busting myself because I didn't really do anything to help defeat the misogyny or the idea of the survivor girl being pure and chaste, you know, in Behind the Mask either. So full disclosure, I just realized I need to turn that, you know, that reflection back on myself and acknowledge that I was guilty of exactly the same thing.
Well, you did subvert it a bit with the, who we expected to be the survivor girl in Behind the Mask. And there is that great reveal, too, I think, when everybody steps into the bedroom. It's one of my favorite moments in the film. But,
right.
But yeah, ultimately Taylor is, I mean, she does sort of fall into that by the end, doesn't she? But, you know, it's still a great character. And I think that the movie's being honest about looking at those movies and sort of, you know, having been, you know, maybe lampooning that genre a bit. But as a fan, I appreciated that.
Well, okay. Thank you for letting me off the hook there. I appreciate that. So, you know, I guess in the future I'm gonna have to maybe write let's get a female slasher killer and see if we can turn the tables 180 degrees, right?
Would your slasher still be called Leslie?
You know what? That's something we talked about in a, you know, that was sort of an intentional, the names of the characters in Behind the Mask are all kind of, you know, well, Taylor and Leslie obviously are both very androgynous. So I was toying with a little bit of not having, you know, being like, you know, Tom and Susie. So I don't know. I don't know if I really had a deeper motivation than that, but I do remember thinking, let's go with something that's a little, you know, I didn't want it to be such a clear characterization just in the name. I wanted it to be a little cloudy.
Very cool. Now, you mentioned, you had talked about that. Is there still a pot? I have to ask, as a fan of Behind the Mask, I adore that movie, but is there a possibility still of a follow-up coming down the road at some point?
Yes, the possibility is there. You know, like you and I had mentioned, we were talking before this, that, you know, I'm always very wary of getting people's hopes up. So I feel like we've sort of pulled the rug out from everybody a couple too many times in the past, you know, 10 years or so. But the desire is there. The story is certainly there. The Leslie Vernon universe, you know, hasn't receded. It's Leslie's been up to plenty of stuff. Taylor's been up to plenty of stuff. You know, and from a filmmaking standpoint, you know, obviously spent a lot of time talking with Scott Glosserman, the producer director on the first one. And, you know, I'm still very close with Nathan. It's never far from our minds, and the characters are certainly living, you know, very rich, full lives. Unfortunately, we just haven't been able to put it together and, you know, to get that whole thing back together, on the business side, just to make the movie work. It's hard. I mean, I'm not telling you anything you and your fans don't know, but when you create an independent film, you know, to get everybody together, it's sort of a minor miracle that the people all come together and they're all available and the story's there and the script is there and the money's there and the actors are there and the locations are there and the camera works and all that stuff happens. It's pretty amazing. But even when you're shooting a first film, you know, for lack of a better way to say it, you don't always get the first people you want. You don't always get the first setting you want. You know, your scenes don't always turn out the way you want them to, just based on location and what's available. So you start out with one intention, and maybe you don't get actor number one for that role. Maybe you get actor number three. Maybe you don't get the location you wanted, but you get this location, so you tweak it a little bit. My point in saying all that is, you know, we got very lucky that everything came together and we got exactly the right people we needed. And now you can't imagine those roles and those characters, you know, without those actors in those roles. You can't imagine, you know, we'd have to go back and find this similar place. So what I'm saying is, to do it once is sort of it's sort of a miracle what comes together. To try to do a sequel, you don't have the luxury of saying, well, we didn't get him, but we're going to get her. You know what I mean? You have to get everybody that you had the first time back together. There's no wiggle room there in a sequel. And it's hard. It's really hard. It's like trying to land we joke and say it's like trying to land a jumbo jet on a, you know, on a balance beam. So it's the story's there. The desire's there. The people are there and ready. It's just a matter of the business end of it not ever coming together yet.
I'm so glad you mentioned that, too. As a fan of the movie, I know personally, like, I am willing to wait so long as everyone makes it back. You know, I can't imagine, you know, some of those roles being recast. I can't imagine anybody else's Leslie Vernon, for example, or Taylor, for that matter.
Absolutely not. You couldn't do it without Nathan at all. And Taylor, and the thing, you know, it gets lost a lot. But, you know, I love it when I get to do these where I get to sort of point this out, so I hope it gets out there further. But, you know, Behind the Mask, it's a slasher. It's a very loving slasher satire, but really it's a love story. You know, this is really, really about Taylor and Leslie, and, you know, these are two people that have come together in the, you know, worst possible way, this, you know, horrible Romeo and Juliet type of a thing. And that's really the core of it. So, you know, with all the stories moving forward, it's always about how in the world do I get Taylor and Leslie back in the same room? How in the world do I get them interacting with each other in a way, given how the movie ended? And that's always been the challenge. But if you don't have Nathan and you don't have Angela in there, you know, you've already set yourself back so far, in my opinion. And Scotty feels the same way. And, you know, Nathan and Angela are both, you know, they're both game for it. But, you know, there's no way to do it without them.
Now, I don't want to push you on it too much. But can I ask, you mentioned that the characters are still living, you know, sort of rich, full lives. And I was wondering, when the film happens, will it ultimately account for the years that have passed? Or will it be, you know, like a lot of slasher films in that, you know, it starts like the next moment after, or a day after, a week after, something like that? Or will there have been some time that has passed in between the films, do you think?
There will have been some time that's passed. It's just not going to be the next minute like Halloween 2. You know, Scotty and I talked about that, and, you know, for various reasons that all come together very nicely, the narrative, the story, the mythology, all of it needs to, even basically just based on what Leslie says during the first movie, how complicated it is, there has to be time that passes before we can create a universe in which it makes any sense that these characters are going to have to be forced to interact again.
Very cool. I for one, can't wait to see it. I think it'll be brilliant. Can I ask one last thing, and I'll leave Behind the Mask alone, I promise. Will it still be, well, not found footage, but sort of the faux documentary style that the bulk of the previous film was? Or will it be more of the traditional slasher film that the final third of the first film was?
That's a great question. And that's something that, you know, that's ultimately, it's not entirely my call. I mean, I have to defer to, you know, Scott has a very clear vision. And, you know, he took the script that I had for the first one and managed to bring it to life in a way that exceeded my expectations. You know, we've talked a lot about the sequel. It is written. And part of it was, how do I answer this without him coming after me and beating me about the head and neck? It took us a long time to figure out a way to get Taylor and Leslie back in the same room. And then the question, as you just mentioned, was, well, how in the world would this happen with a camera over their shoulders? And the best answer I can give you is that there's a development, there's an arc that Leslie is going through and what he's trying to do that's going to naturally push him, unfortunately, you know, farther and farther from the jovial, engaging guy who can laugh and joke on a documentary camera to, you know, in the scope of it, ultimately what he's trying to do, if he's going to become a Jason or a Michael, he's clearly not going to be able to be accessible in that way. So where are we in his evolution, and where is Taylor? How far is she trailing, and where is she in that? And her, you know, they're traveling parallel tracks, of course. And all I can say is we found a way to bridge that gap between the aw shucks, you know, mockumentary style of what everybody loves about Leslie, you know, Leslie Mancuso, when he's not in character as the boy. We found a way to get some of that back, but at the same time realizing that, you know, these are two people that went through a pretty horrible ordeal, and Taylor's pretty pissed, you know? And so there's a way. We found a way, but I can't really say any more than that.
Okay, fair enough. Thanks so much for saying that. I appreciate it. So, and I got to imagine I'm not alone in that. I'm dying to see the follow-up to the film, so I can't wait.
we're dying to get it out there. So, and I can say it's not lost on Scotty or myself or anybody involved in the first one that it's fans, it's the fan sites and the horror community in general, especially the horror community that supports independent horror. We would be nowhere without you guys. I absolutely 100% mean that. There's the theatrical release was a disaster. We're all grown-ups. We're fully willing to admit that. And the film, by all rights, should have been dead and gone, you know, 2 months after it was out. But it's not. And it's just growing, and it's growing and growing. And it's completely because of the underground independent horror film community that has absolutely championed Leslie Vernon and embraced him and keeps him out there and keeps him in the conversation. And he shows up in articles and lists. And it's overwhelming, the amount of support. It's unbelievably, I can't even express my gratitude for the fact that you guys, the horror community, has kept Leslie Vernon Behind the Mask, even in the conversation that people are still 10 years later saying, when is the sequel going to happen? We want to tell it. We want to give you more of Leslie Vernon. And we wouldn't have a chance to even be having this conversation without you guys.
Very cool. Well, thanks again for having made the first movie in the first place. It felt like when it came out, it was sort of a gift to fans of the genre and, you know, to movies like Halloween, or for fans of movies like Halloween, rather. So, but yeah, cool. I can't wait. So, okay, back to Halloween just for a second. I gotta ask, you know, we've been talking about the writing and talking about the story, but can we just chat for a second about the craft of the film and how incredibly well made it is?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not great on the production side of things. I'll be the first one to tell you. I don't know the first thing about pointing a camera, but watching it, there's really no wasted space in there. It's a slow movie. There's not a lot happening. So by today's standards, again, I think, you know, people coming to it for the first time would be like, this is, you know, they'd want to hit the fast forward button. But to me, I don't know. It's just, it works, and it's a pretty fast, what is it, an hour and a half, 2 hours? I think it's just under 2 hours. And I think it's, even though it's bordering on monotonous at times, the monotony works. And I think, I don't know. I have a lot more patience, I think, viewing films like that. But to me, there's no wasted space in that movie.
Yeah, agreed. And, it's so beautiful, too. Like, Dean Cundey's photography in the film was gorgeous, and Carpenter's music is just superb. I mean, do you think there's a more iconic piece of music in all of horror than that main Halloween theme?
Absolutely not. I mean, I don't think there's a more iconic piece of music other than maybe Jaws in all of cinema.
Yeah, true. Very true. Jaws. Certainly those two. I mean, they're so...
Or maybe 2001. I don't know, but that wasn't original. You know what I mean? So I don't know, man. I'd be hard-pressed if somebody had to come up with a piece of music that's more immediately attached to a film and a mood.
Right. Yeah, it's funny, though, mentioning the music. I mean, John Carpenter, not only did he co-write the film, you know, he directed it. He did the music. And ultimately, it's Carpenter's name that goes above the title. You know, it's not merely a film by John Carpenter. I mean, it's John Carpenter's Halloween. And, you know, one of the things I wanted to ask you, as a writer, how do you feel about that sort of possessory credit, not only in this movie, but like in filmmaking in general?
I take it at face value. I think, given the quality of what the person's putting out there. I guess I feel like it's to put your name above the line on something, or, you know, a film by, or, blow, you know, such and such as, you know, parentheses S, or apostrophe S. I think it can be very tricky if it's just a narcissistic sort of a, you know, vanity thing. But it's also your right as a storyteller or creator to say, look, this is mine. And I mean, I'm very sensitive to, you know, in the film industry in particular, the content creator, the writer really somehow is sort of a, you know, pushed to the bottom of the stack. It's not the same way it is in television. You know, showrunners are the king. Obviously Broadway playwrights are the king. You see that a lot more, you know, Neil Simon's this or blah, blah, blah. It's a lot more common, I think, even in literature, I think the name of the author becomes its own, you know, thing. Dean Koontz or Stephen King or et cetera, et cetera. Only in film is the writer, the content creator, pushed to the bottom of the barrel, and it's infuriating. But it's just somehow that's the way the film industry in particular has evolved. So in that sense, you know, if somebody wants to put their name above the title, good for them. You know, the writer in me says, absolutely, brother, you know, it's fight the power, right? But I think if it becomes, how do I say this right? If it's a stinking pile of crap, or they, maybe a person doesn't have their, you know, they don't have the resume, you know, to back it up, and that they keep doing it, I think you can very easily cross over into narcissism. So I feel like initially, if you're going to do that, great, but you better have the product to back it up. Otherwise, you're sort of setting that cause back. If you're just putting your name up there because, you know, you're paying the bills and you're putting out a piece of junk, you're not helping yourself or that, you know, that fight that I was just talking about. So it's kind of, I don't know if that's an answer, but it's kind of got to be a case by case. If you're going to put your name in front of a movie, you better have a pretty good product after your name.
Having revisited this movie just recently to prepare for this conversation, and, you know, I mean, it's getting to be fall. I was planning on watching all of these movies a few times again anyway, you know, the entire franchise. But, you know, I was struck by a couple of moments throughout. You know, it's such a well-crafted movie, and yet there are moments that feel a little... I don't want to knock the movie because I adore the movie, but in the interest of being completely honest, I'll say, you know, there are moments that are kind of dodgy in it. You know, that great opening sequence, you know, there's that amazing point of view shot and the that sort of marvelous steady cam work. But it's also kind of unintentionally hilarious when you realize, I mean, it's one unbroken take. So you realize that poor Judith and her boyfriend have had sex for all of, like, what, 90 seconds at the beginning of the movie? You know, did anybody think about that on set? Was it meant to be kind of a gag in a way, you know? And then we have, like, you know, we have that strange moment with Michael and his parents, you know, the big reveal when he steps out and the mask is pulled off and he's standing there with a knife and the camera cranes up super high. And, you know, I always just kind of bought that moment, you know, when I was a kid watching the movie. But watching it again as an adult, it's such a strange choice to have them discover their son holding a bloody knife.
Right. And there's that. Nobody reacts on that. And they all open so nicely to the camera and stand there and hold their poses. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. And it's such a weird moment. But I mean, the movie isn't flawless. And yet what it gets right, it gets so right that, you know, as a viewer and a fan, I'm willing to sort of look past some of those flaws and, you know, even kind of find them charming in a way. But, you know, I have to admit, I don't hate me for this. Not only you, but listeners out there, please. Don't come at me with daggers for this, but that moment is sort of paid homage to in the Rob Zombie remake, and arguably he kind of did right. That one moment better, where it seems like all of time stands still around Michael, you know, as he looks at the camera, which I thought was kind of interesting. But yeah, that is one thing I wanted to ask you about. I mean, we talked about the sequels a little bit. As a fan of the first movie, how do you feel about the Zombie remake and its sequel?
Well, before I will answer that, but I do want to say, I mean, just to your point, I would remind you to, you know, keep in mind that, you know, it was 1978. It was, you know, an independent filmmaker. And so that transition from, you know, I think film went through a transition from, you know, theatrical stage plays to, you know, being performances to trying to capture it on film. So there still was a little bit of that, I think, ingrained in John Carpenter, probably. There still was a little bit of that. You know, look, this is a fantastic world we're creating. So they wasn't quite the same homage to reality that, you know, that Rob Zombie is sort of, you know, adhering to. But I also, to me, it's always a conversation I have about Blade Runner, not to get totally off track, but
no,
you know, I'm always touting Blade Runner as, you know, I think it's the greatest sci-fi film of all time. And people who haven't seen it before, you know, like my girlfriend, I made her watch it for the first time, you know, and there's always this reaction of, well, what's the big deal? I've seen this a million times before. And so people lose perspective on, yeah, but this was case number one. So I think that, you know, in retrospect, there's a little bit of that that maybe I think, you know, Halloween is unfortunately subjected to, which is, it still was the first to do that, to have a, you know, to have a perspective of a killer going up the stairs and then pulling back out and transitioning out. And it's a little kid. Like that was sort of the first time anybody had ever done that. So I am willing to forgive its hokiness and its bumps along the way, again, because to me it's 1978. But that's just me. But to answer your question, I'm fine with the remakes. I've come a long way on Rob Zombie. I wasn't a big fan of his work early on. I'm not a big gore guy. I think to me there's a difference between being scared and being, you know, visibly upset. There's a difference between being scared and being grossed out. Gore and blood and guts and people holding their own limbs and things falling off of people's bodies and guts spilling out, like that doesn't scare me later when I'm driving home in the car by myself down a country road. You know, Michael Myers popping up in the back seat, that scares me when I'm driving home in a car by myself on a country road. And the reason I say that is because I felt early on that Rob Zombie was just going for the gore and the visual startles and the scares. I didn't really get any of the sort of terror. And I was wrong. I mean, I've come around on Rob Zombie's work. I think, you know, he obviously loves the genre and what he's doing is coming from a place of love. And I respect that. And, you know, the sequels and the remakes and the everything that's plaguing it, I get it. We want to try to recapture those feelings we had when he was little or when I was little. I mean, we want to try to recreate what, you know, the feelings we had, we liked. So I don't know. I don't object to the sequels and the remakes and the reloads and relaunches or whatever. I just, you know, because I understand it's coming from a place of love, you know, unless it's just an overt cash grab from a studio. But I don't know. I, you know, to me, I'd rather just go back and rewatch the original, but that's just me.
Fair enough. And it does have sort of, I mean, in a way, the film ends in such a way that it feels like it does set up a sequel, but in a way, not. I mean, there is that great final sequence that closes the film, you know, showing those static shots of the various locations that Michael had been during, during his stay in Haddonfield, as though, Well, what? I mean, you know, it's showing all the places that he had marked almost, maybe, that, you know, are we to take it as viewers to mean that these are the places in this town would never be the same in a way? Or is it meant to be simpler, do you think? I mean, is it just merely all the places that he might be hiding or, you know, might be hanging out just around the corner ready to strike again? But, you know, there is that sound of his labored breathing over many of those final shots, almost as though he's existing in all of those places at once.
Yeah, I think to me, I take it to mean, you know, he's clearly, you know, clearly he's not dead. I think there are some people that say, you know, that when his body vanishes, you know, that he's somehow he's transcended or, you know, crossed over to the supernatural world. I don't really buy that. I think he just got up and, you know, walked away. But I don't know. I think when you the static shots to me, I don't know. I guess to me, it's sort of a reminder of, look, this is the inception of this boogeyman. This is, you know, the shape, right? It's sort of all of the fertile soil is still there. And it's almost, there's nothing complicated about it. I mean, this is a guy who, you know, he returned to his roots and that's all he's known. And he's sort of finding different ways to interact with the world, you know, as it is today, but he's going back through, you know, the same places, you know, and he has a very limited range, I guess. So I don't know. To me, I think it's, you know, you look at the ground in the fall and the winter, and it's everything's dead and there's nothing growing there. But you know, in the spring, stuff's going to come up. So I don't know if there's an analogy to be made there, but I feel like you're just sort of, yeah, you're looking at the shape may be gone for now, but whatever brought him into inception in the first place, that fertile soil is still there.
Now that we've talked about Halloween, and given that you've written a slasher classic in its own right, can I ask, if given the opportunity, where might you take the Halloween franchise? Or, you know, as a fan, where might you like to see it go?
Oh, man. Wow. That's like, that just made me almost nervous with the excitement of that. But I mean, that would be such a massive responsibility. It actually made me nervous. To me, I can tell you for sure it would, Michael would not, he wouldn't be a superhero, like, you know, it's not a superhero. He wouldn't be a sort of superhuman figure like Jason is. Like, to me, Michael is, like I said, just, you know, he's a shape, he's an entity that exists in his own right. And I think that, you know, there's an evil in that and there's something scary about that when it doesn't need to be really explained or motivated. I don't know. It's interesting because there's so many, you know, would Laurie Strode still be alive? Would, you know, how do I bring her back to me? Again, obviously I said before, I'm a big fan of the inherent love stories and all these. And I think for whatever reason, you know, Laurie and Michael are connected. So that would have to be part of it for me. I guess I'd have to look for some sort of where are they in their relationship? How are each of them advancing the mythology of what it means to be a boogeyman and to be a victim or the person that's sort of, you know, like I said, like traveling in those sort of concentric circles. I don't know. How would I guess I'd have to find some sort of hybrid. It would probably be an, you know, alternate reality, different future type of thing that's much more in line with one and two. I don't know. If I couldn't have Michael and Laurie interacting and have somehow Loomis's presence or his spirit or, you know, something of him in that, I think those are the three pieces that I would have to have.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it is, as much as I love Halloween H2O, you know, and I think it would have been actually a nice closer to that franchise before they, you know, went one further with Halloween Resurrection, which is a movie I despise on several different levels. But you can feel Loomis missing. Like, you need him in that film as much as you need. I mean, Halloween 4 and 5 have Jamie Lloyd, and she more or less takes the place of Laurie Strode in those films. But then you get to the sixth one, and she's sort of unceremoniously killed, and you don't really have anyone taking your place. I mean, the movie has its heroes, and Loomis is still there. But you're right. I think you need that sort of you need that trinity in Halloween, I think. You need the boogeyman, you need, well, the Ahab, and you need the survivor girl, I think. And
I don't know that I feel like I would need to bring, you know, Loomis back, you know, resurrect him, or he wasn't really dead or something. There's probably other ways that his influence could be there, but I don't know. Now that I think about it more, if it was turned over to me and I was lucky enough to do that, I think, you know, I don't think there's anything wrong either with having a little closure on a story on characters like this. I mean, if there's some sort of actual finality that, you know, maybe Michael can get whatever it is he's after, or there's some closure with Laurie finally, you know, sort of ending him once and for all, and, you know, there's a sacrifice there, or, you know, Loomis's memory or spirit, or, you know, something is critical to that. Like, that to me, I guess, would be the appeal of a franchise like this. It would be nice to finish the tale. And then, you know, everybody obviously would shudder at that idea in Hollywood, because you, of course, you can't leave any money on the table. But I don't know, if it was up to me, I think I would find a way to end the Laurie Michael love story once and for all.
I'm glad you said that, because, you know, as a fan of horror movies, that is one thing that a lot of big franchises never have. They never have an ending. I catch a lot of hell for, you know, admitting my love for this film, but, you know, Mick Garris's Psycho 4 has a great ending for a, you know, if you want to call Norman Bates a slasher character. And that's something that's not really given to many of the icons often. There isn't closure. There isn't a natural end to those tales. And I think as a result, they're always kind of, that is a weakness, I think, of the storytelling in some of those franchises. And I wish it were the case that a lot of them would build toward an ending, but that's just me.
I agree. I mean, every story needs its ending. It's just, that's how we're wired as human beings. And, you know, it's been a hell of a run, but I mean, it's, if you don't deliver the ending, you haven't really delivered on the promise of telling a story. I mean, that's how we absorb. That's how we incorporate things into our life and then move on.
I agree. All right, sir. I think that's just about our time. Thank you so much for being on the show and for choosing this movie to talk about. It's one of my favorite horror movies. It's one of my favorite movies, period. And I'm glad to have been able to talk about it with you.
It's been a pleasure, man. And I thank you again for having me on. And, you know, happy Halloween season to everyone out there. This is the best time of the year.
Agreed. And listeners, thanks so much for checking this episode out. Please be sure to like, subscribe, share, use the comment section below. Maybe leave us an iTunes review and yell at us on Facebook or Twitter. That's at Screamaddicts, and I am at Jinx1981. That's JINX1981. Be sure to use the Amazon links below to purchase Behind the Mask or the Halloween films. Remember, any Amazon purchase you make through our site will help ensure that there will be a new episode next week. And we still have that deal for you through Audible. Make certain to sign up for a free 30-day trial, and you'll get 2 free books. So thanks so much for listening, folks, and have a great weekend.
What's the boogeyman?
As a matter of fact, it was.